A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's back with a two-parter that sounds like it's about maps, but is really about who gets to write the rules and where the ink runs out. He wants us to look at the Gaza Strip during the 19 years Egypt administered it, from 48 to 67, and then pivot to Jerusalem's legal status after 67, and how it differs from the rest of the West Bank. The thing that connects both, I think, is that neither place was ever just occupied territory in the normal sense. They were both held in a kind of legal suspension.
The Gaza Peace is the one most people have never thought about. Egypt never annexed it. That's the crucial thing. Jordan annexed the West Bank in 1950 and called it part of the Hashemite Kingdom. Egypt did the opposite. They kept Gaza in a permanent state of wartime administration, technically under Egyptian military control, but legally distinct from Egypt itself. An Egyptian in Cairo needed a permit to go to Gaza. A Gazan couldn't just move to Alexandria.
So it was occupied by Egypt, but not Egyptian.
Well, not exactly, but that's the shape of it. Egypt ran the strip through a military governor, and the legal fiction was that Egypt was holding it as a kind of trusteeship for the Palestinian people. The All-Palestine government was proclaimed in Gaza in September 1948, a body that was supposed to be the embryo of a Palestinian state, but it had no real authority. Egypt controlled the budget, the police, the courts. The government sat in Cairo after 1952 and faded into irrelevance.
The All-Palestine government is one of those footnotes that sounds enormous, and then you find out it controlled nothing. It had a flag and a national anthem and no post office.
It had a parliament that met a handful of times in Gaza. The Egyptian military governor had to approve everything, but it mattered symbolically because it let Egypt say it wasn't annexing Gaza, it was safeguarding Palestinian interests. That distinction kept Egypt's hands clean in Arab League politics, and also meant Gaza never became part of Egypt's domestic legal order. No Egyptian constitution applied there. No Egyptian citizenship for Gazans.
Which is strange when you think about it. Egypt controlled the place for nearly two decades, and didn't even try to integrate it.
And the reason is partly ideological and partly practical. Ideologically, Nasser, after 52, framed Egypt as the leader of the Arab world, and annexing Palestinian territory would have undercut the whole pan-Arab argument. It'd have looked like Egypt was carving off a piece of Palestine for itself. Practically, Gaza was a burden. The population had roughly doubled in 1948, with refugees from the areas that became Israel. The strip is tiny, about 365 square kilometers, and by the mid-50s it held something like 300,000 people, most of them refugees in camps.
300,000 people in a place you could walk across in a day.
And that's the other thing. The population density was already extreme by 1955. Egypt had no interest in absorbing that demographic and economic problem. So the arrangement was, Egypt administers, the UN provides relief through UNRWA, and the refugees stay in limbo waiting for return. The strip ran on a kind of triage economy. There was some agriculture, citrus mostly, and smuggling across the border with Israel. The border was sealed after 49, but sealed borders have holes.
The armistice line there was never quiet. The 50s saw infiltrations, Israeli reprisal raids, and the Egyptians trying to control a population that had every reason to be angry. Egypt didn't want Gaza to become a base for Fedayeen attacks that would drag it into a war it wasn't ready for.
And yet it did become that, partly. The Fedayeen units operated from Gaza in the mid-50s, and Egypt's control over them was uneven. Some were sponsored by Egyptian intelligence, others were freelance. When Israel launched raids into Gaza in 1955, one of the consequences was that Nasser accelerated his turn toward the Soviet bloc for arms. The Gaza raid in February 55 is one of those hinge events. An Israeli operation killed 38 Egyptian soldiers and wounded dozens more. Nasser concluded he couldn't rely on the West for weapons and went shopping in Prague.
That raid gets overshadowed by Suez the next year, but it's arguably the moment the Cold War arrived in the Middle East, because before that, Nasser was still talking to the Americans.
And the Americans were trying to court him. The Gaza raid broke that. Then Suez in 56, when Israel captured Gaza and held it for 4 months before withdrawing under American and Soviet pressure. That's a period almost nobody discusses. Israel occupied Gaza from November 56 to March 57. The Israeli military governor actually began dismantling the Fedayeen infrastructure, and there were reprisals against Palestinians suspected of collaborating with the Egyptians. Then Israel withdrew and Egypt came back.
With UNEF, the United Nations Emergency Force, stationed along the border and at Sharm el-Sheikh. That was the buffer that kept the peace until Nasser ordered them out in May 67.
And that's the direct prelude to the Six-Day War. Nasser's demand that UNEF leave, the remilitarization of Sinai, the closure of the Straits of Tehran. Gaza was the tripwire. Egypt's military governor in Gaza, General Abdul Mohsen Kamel, was actually in the Strip when the war started. The Egyptian army's Gaza division collapsed quickly under Israeli assault. By June 7th, Israel controlled the whole Strip.
So the Egyptian period ends with a whimper. 19 years of military administration, a puppet government that governed nothing, a refugee population stuck in legal limbo, and then the whole thing folds in about 2 days of fighting.
But here's what Daniel's question gets at, and it's the part that matters for understanding what came after. Egypt never established a clear legal framework for Gaza. It was administered under Egyptian military law, but the law itself was a patchwork. British Mandate Law remained in force for most civil matters. Egyptian military orders covered security. The All-Palestine government issued some legislation that nobody enforced. So when Israel captured Gaza in 67, what did it inherit? A legal system that was already a mess.
That's the point that gets missed. People talk about occupation law as if there was a clean pre-existing legal order that Israel disrupted. In Gaza, the pre-existing order was itself an occupation, and a legally murky one.
Israel's approach was to keep Egyptian military law in place for the most part, layering Israeli military orders on top. The Israeli military governor in Gaza issued orders that amended Egyptian law. Some Egyptian military orders from the 1950s remained enforceable in Gaza until the disengagement in 2005. That's a remarkable continuity. A law passed by an Egyptian brigadier in 1954 could still be cited in a Gaza courtroom in 2004.
And the boundary itself, the physical line of the Strip. Daniel mentioned it juts into the Israel-Egypt border. That shape isn't ancient. It's an armistice line from 1949.
The Gaza Strip, as we know, it's the product of the Egyptian-Israeli armistice agreement signed at Rhodes in February 49. The line wasn't drawn by geography or history. It was drawn by the position of forces at the end of the fighting. The Egyptian army had advanced up the coast to a point near Ashdod, and the armistice line essentially froze the front. What's striking is how arbitrary it is. The line cuts through villages, through agricultural land. Beit Hanun in the north, Rafah in the south, the line runs right up against the sea in the west and stops at the desert in the east.
And the eastern boundary is just as artificial. The line between Gaza and Israel in the east was drawn through the middle of nowhere, mostly sand dunes and farmland. The town of Abasan, for instance, was split. Part ended up in Gaza, part in Israel.
The boundary also created the peculiar geographic situation where Gaza touches Egypt only at Rafah, a narrow crossing point. The rest of the southern boundary is just desert. So the Strip is this coastal rectangle that depends entirely on two external connections, the Rafah crossing to Egypt and the Erez crossing to Israel. Both were closed for long periods. During the Egyptian administration, the border with Israel was sealed, and the crossing to Egypt was tightly controlled. Gazans were effectively trapped in a small coastal enclave for 19 years.
And the sea. The Mediterranean was the only open boundary, and fishing was restricted. The Egyptians limited how far Gazan fishermen could go. Israel later did the same. It's a place that's been bounded on all sides for most of its modern history.
Now pivot to Jerusalem, because Daniel's second question is about how the Israeli legal framework applied to East Jerusalem after 67 differs from the West Bank. And the answer is that Jerusalem wasn't treated as occupied territory under Israeli law. It was treated as annexed.
That's the clean version. The messier version is that Israel didn't call it annexation. The Knesset passed an amendment to the Law and Administration Ordinance in June 67, authorizing the government to apply Israeli law, jurisdiction, and administration to any area of the land of Israel designated by order. Then the government issued an order applying it to East Jerusalem and some surrounding areas.
The territory was defined not by the armistice line, but by a new municipal boundary drawn by an Israeli committee. The area was expanded significantly. It included the Old City, the Arab neighborhoods to the north and east, and a bunch of villages that had never been part of the Jerusalem municipality under Jordan. The boundary was drawn to include as much land as possible with as few Arab residents as possible, which is why it snakes around in that strange way.
And the legal effect was that Israeli law applied wholesale. Not military law layered on top of existing law, but the full Israeli legal system. East Jerusalem Palestinians became residents of Israel under the entry into Israel law, not citizens. They got Israeli ID cards. They could move freely within Israel. They could work without permits, but they couldn't vote in national elections unless they applied for citizenship.
That's the unique status. In the West Bank, the Israeli military commander issues orders under the law of belligerent occupation. The Jordanian legal system remained in force for most civil matters. In East Jerusalem, the Knesset legislates directly. Israeli criminal law applies. Israeli civil law applies. The Israeli courts have jurisdiction. It's as if the Green Line never existed for legal purposes.
And the international community has never accepted this. The UN Security Council passed Resolution 252 in May 68, calling the annexation measures invalid. The International Court of Justice, in its 2004 advisory opinion, said East Jerusalem is occupied territory. Israel's position is that Jerusalem is the unified capital, and the extension of Israeli law wasn't annexation, but the application of law to territory that's part of the sovereign state.
The distinction between municipal law and military law is the key. In the West Bank, the military governor issues orders. In East Jerusalem, the Knesset passes laws and the Jerusalem municipality enforces them. When the Israeli government builds a neighborhood in East Jerusalem like Ramot or Pisgat Ziv, it's not a military construction project. It's a municipal housing development under Israeli planning law. When the Israeli government builds in the West Bank, it goes through a different legal channel entirely, the civil administration and the military planning system.
Which means the legal status of a piece of land can change depending on which side of an invisible line it falls on. The same hillside, the same neighborhood, but different law.
And the boundary between Jerusalem and the West Bank isn't the 1949 armistice line. It's the expanded municipal boundary drawn in 67. So there are areas that were part of the West Bank under Jordanian rule that are now inside the Jerusalem municipality. Places like Shuafat, Beit Hanina, Kafa Aqab, some of them are on the far side of the separation barrier that was built in the 2000s, which created the bizarre situation where tens of thousands of Jerusalem residents live on the West Bank side of the wall and get almost no municipal services.
The wall turned the municipal boundary into a kind of fiction. You have people with Jerusalem IDs living in neighborhoods that are physically separated from Jerusalem by a concrete barrier. They pay municipal taxes technically, but the city doesn't collect the garbage.
And the legal status of those residents is now a maze. They're residents of Israel, but they live in territory that Israel doesn't fully control. They can't easily reach Jerusalem. Their children go to schools run by the Palestinian Authority or by private organizations. The Israeli police rarely enter. It's a legal gray zone created by the interaction of the 67 annexation and the 2000s barrier.
Daniel's question about how military rule applied to Jerusalem versus the West Bank has an answer, but the answer keeps getting more complicated the closer you look. The formal distinction is clear. Jerusalem got Israeli law, the West Bank got military law, but the reality on the ground has blurred that distinction in both directions.
In the West Bank, the military legal system has become so entrenched that it functions like a parallel civilian legal system for Israeli settlers. Israeli settlers in the West Bank aren't subject to military courts for most criminal matters. They're tried in Israeli civilian courts under Israeli law, even though they live in territory under military occupation. That's a legal innovation that has no basis in the law of belligerent occupation. The personal law follows the person, not the territory.
So, an Israeli settler in Hebron is under Israeli law, and a Palestinian in Hebron is under military law, and they live on the same street. That's not occupation law, as it was understood in 1949. That's something else.
And in East Jerusalem, the situation is inverted. Palestinians there are subject to Israeli law, but they're not citizens. They're permanent residents, which is a status Israel created for people who live in Israel but aren't citizens. It can be revoked. Since 1967, thousands of East Jerusalem Palestinians have had their residency revoked, often for living abroad or for security reasons. The revocation of residency is a power that applies to them but not to Jewish residents of Jerusalem who are citizens.
The asymmetry is the point. Jewish residents of Jerusalem are citizens with full voting rights. Arab residents of Jerusalem are permanent residents with limited rights. Same city, same law, different status.
And that's the part that gets lost in discussions about Jerusalem. People say Israel annexed East Jerusalem, and that's true in the sense that Israeli law applies. But the people who lived there weren't made citizens. They were made residents. The annexation was territorial, but not personal. The land was incorporated, the people were not.
Which is the opposite of what Egypt did in Gaza. Egypt didn't annex the land, but did create a Palestinian political identity, however hollow. Israel annexed the land, but didn't incorporate the people. Two different legal strategies, both leaving the population in a kind of suspended citizenship.
The comparison is actually quite sharp. Egypt and Gaza, from 48 to 67, no annexation, no citizenship, military administration, a puppet Palestinian government. Israel and East Jerusalem from 67 onward, annexation of territory, no citizenship for the Arab population, full Israeli law, permanent residency. Both created a population that lives under a legal system it didn't choose and can't fully participate in.
Both were responding to the same underlying problem. What do you do with territory you control but don't want to fully absorb? Egypt didn't want Gaza's refugees. Israel didn't want East Jerusalem's Arab population. So both found legal mechanisms to control the land without granting full membership to the people.
The difference is that Egypt's arrangement was temporary by design. It was always framed as a holding operation until Palestine was liberated. Israel's arrangement in Jerusalem was meant to be permanent. The Knesset legislated as if the question was settled. The law applied to Jerusalem wasn't written as an occupation measure. It was written as the law of the land.
That's why the international response has been so consistent. The UN has passed resolution after resolution saying the Jerusalem measures are null and void, but Israel's position is that the Knesset has spoken and the matter is closed. The legal argument is essentially that Israel extended its sovereignty to Jerusalem, and sovereignty isn't something you can undo with a UN resolution.
The problem for that argument is that sovereignty over territory acquired by force is exactly what the post-war legal order was designed to prevent. The UN Charter prohibits the acquisition of territory by war. The Fourth Geneva Convention prohibits the transfer of civilian population into occupied territory. Israel's annexation of East Jerusalem and the subsequent settlement construction are widely viewed as violations of both.
Israel's counter-argument is that East Jerusalem wasn't occupied territory in the legal sense, because Jordan's prior control was itself illegal. Jordan had occupied East Jerusalem in 48 in a war of aggression, so Israel's capture in 67 was the recovery of territory that rightfully belonged to the Jewish state. That's the argument. It hasn't persuaded the international community, but it's not a frivolous argument.
The Jordanian occupation is another one of those periods that gets glossed over. Jordan controlled East Jerusalem for 19 years and did almost nothing to develop it. The old city was neglected. The Jewish quarter was destroyed and its residents expelled. The Western Wall was inaccessible to Jews. Jordanian rule in East Jerusalem wasn't exactly a golden age.
Which doesn't make Israel's later annexation legal. But it does complicate the narrative that East Jerusalem was a thriving Arab city that Israel disrupted. It was a divided city under Jordanian military rule, with the border running right through the middle.
The border in Jerusalem was a physical wall. The city was split by barbed wire and minefields. The Mandelbaum Gate was the only crossing point. Families were separated. The Mount of Olives Cemetery was on the Jordanian side, and Jews couldn't visit their relatives' graves. It was a hard division, not a soft one.
When Israel captured East Jerusalem in 67, there was a real sense among Israelis that this was reunification, not conquest. The city had been artificially divided, and now it was whole again. That's the emotional logic behind the annexation. It's also the legal logic, such as it is.
The emotional logic is powerful. The Western Wall, the Jewish Quarter, the Temple Mount. These aren't just pieces of real estate. For Israelis, the capture of East Jerusalem was the recovery of the core of Jewish identity. The Knesset's extension of Israeli law to East Jerusalem was passed with overwhelming support and almost no debate. It wasn't controversial in Israel. It was seen as the obvious thing to do.
The controversy came later, when the implications became clear. The demographic implications, the legal implications, the international implications. But in June 67, the Israeli consensus was that Jerusalem was now unified, and that was that.
That consensus has held. The Jerusalem Law of 1980 declared Jerusalem the complete and united capital of Israel. Every Israeli government since has maintained that position. Even the Oslo Accords, which created the Palestinian Authority and transferred territory in the West Bank and Gaza, left Jerusalem as a final status issue. The Palestinians have never accepted the annexation, and the international community has never recognized it, but Israel has never budged.
The result is a legal situation that's unique in the world. A city that's claimed as the capital of two peoples, governed under the domestic law of one, with a population that's divided between citizens and permanent residents, surrounded by a barrier that doesn't match the municipal boundary, in territory that most of the world considers occupied.
The Gaza comparison is instructive because it shows what happens when the legal framework is left deliberately ambiguous. Egypt's ambiguity in Gaza meant that when Israel captured the Strip, there was no clear legal baseline. Israel could argue that Egypt was never the sovereign, so the law of belligerent occupation applied in a modified form. The same argument was made about the West Bank after Jordan's annexation was rejected by most of the world. Jordan claimed sovereignty, but only Britain and Pakistan recognized it.
In both cases, the prior administrator's legal status was contested, and that contest shaped everything that came after. Egypt's refusal to annex Gaza meant the Strip was legally orphaned. Jordan's annexation of the West Bank was rejected internationally, so its sovereignty there was also contested. Israel inherited two territories with no clear sovereign.
Israel's response to the two territories was completely different. In Gaza, Israel maintained the pre-existing Egyptian military law and ruled through a military governor. In the West Bank, Israel maintained Jordanian law and ruled through a military governor. But in East Jerusalem, Israel wiped the slate clean and applied Israeli law directly. The difference was entirely political. Jerusalem mattered to Israel in a way that Gaza and the West Bank did not.
The legal distinction was never about law. It was about identity. Jerusalem was part of the Jewish story. Gaza was a problem to be managed. The West Bank was somewhere in between, full of biblical sites, but also full of Palestinians.
That's the thing Daniel's question exposes. The legal frameworks are all downstream of the political decisions. Egypt didn't annex Gaza because it didn't want Gaza. Israel annexed East Jerusalem because it wanted Jerusalem desperately. The law followed the politics, not the other way around.
The short answer to Daniel's question is, Egypt administered Gaza as occupied territory under military law with a puppet Palestinian government, and Israel applied its own domestic law to East Jerusalem as if it were part of the sovereign state. The West Bank got the occupation law treatment. Jerusalem got the annexation treatment. Gaza got the orphan treatment.
The long answer is that none of these frameworks ever worked as intended. Egypt's administration of Gaza collapsed in a day. Israel's annexation of Jerusalem has produced a permanent legal crisis. The military occupation of the West Bank has lasted longer than any occupation in modern history. The legal categories keep failing because the underlying political questions were never resolved.
Hilbert's been quiet back there.
The Egyptian military orders in Gaza weren't all repealed until 2005, when Israel pulled out. I used to know a man who worked at the Rafah crossing in the 70s. He said the file cabinet still had Egyptian army stamps on half the forms.
That's a detail that tells you everything. 19 years of Egyptian administration, and the paperwork outlasted the administration by decades.
The administrative continuity is striking. Israel captured Gaza in 67 and just kept using the Egyptian forms. why would you reprint the forms when the old ones work? The law of occupation actually encourages that. You're supposed to maintain the existing legal order unless military necessity requires otherwise.
The man at Rafa said the stamps were in Arabic and Hebrew by the end. Somebody had made a rubber stamp with both. He said it was the ugliest stamp he'd ever seen, and he'd seen the one they used for the cement import permits.
The cement import permits? That's a whole other episode. The Gaza reconstruction economy ran on cement imports, and the permits were controlled by whoever happened to be in charge. Egypt controlled them, then Israel, then Hamas.
The consequence nobody talks about with the Jerusalem annexation is the property records. When Israel extended its law to East Jerusalem, it didn't just change the criminal code, it changed the land registry system. The Jordanian land records were in Arabic, based on the Ottoman system. The Israeli system was in Hebrew, based on the British system. Merging them took years, and a lot of records were never properly transferred. There are parcels in East Jerusalem where the legal ownership is still disputed because the Jordanian registration was never fully reconciled with the Israeli registry.
That's a real problem, and it's still causing litigation. The Ottoman land code classified land in ways that don't map cleanly onto the Israeli system. Miri land, Malul land, Waqf land. The categories don't translate. So you have courts trying to figure out whether a piece of land in Beit Safafa is Miri or Mahlul, and the answer determines who owns it.
The man at Rafa had a similar problem with the cement permits. He said the Egyptian permits were numbered in the sequence that nobody understood, so they just started a new sequence in 67. For about 3 months, there were two permit number 104. Nobody knew which was which.
Two permits with the same number. That's the whole legal history of Gaza in miniature.
The property records point is important because it shows that annexation isn't just a constitutional act. It's an administrative act that touches every file, every form, every registry. When Israel extended its law to East Jerusalem, it had to convert an entire legal system from one language and tradition to another. The conversion was never complete.
Same with the Egyptian military orders. Israel kept them in force, but translated them into Hebrew. The translations weren't always accurate. There was one order about fishing limits that said something different in Arabic and Hebrew. The Israeli Navy enforced the Hebrew version. The fishermen quoted the Arabic version. Neither side ever resolved it.
The fishing limits in Gaza are still contested to this day. The allowed distance from shore has changed repeatedly, from 6 nautical miles to 3 to 9 to 15 and back. The fishermen never know what the rule is.
The fishing zone is a perfect example of how legal ambiguity becomes a practical problem. The rule was never stable, so the fishermen treated every trip as a gamble. The Navy treated every boat as a potential violation. The result was constant friction with no clear legal standard.
The cement permits were the same way. The rules changed every few months. 1 month you needed 3 signatures, the next month 4. The man at Rafa said the only consistent thing was that the last signature was always the hardest to get.
The last signature being the hardest to get isn't a Gaza problem. That's a universal law of bureaucracy.
But it's worse when the bureaucracy is layered on top of a legal system that was already a patchwork. Gaza under Egypt had British Mandate Law, Egyptian military orders, and the occasional decree from the All-Palestine government. Israel added its own military orders on top. The Palestinians later added their own legislation under the Palestinian Authority. By the time Hamas took over in 2007, the legal system in Gaza was a sedimentary deposit of 4 different regimes.
The same is true in Jerusalem, just with different layers. Ottoman land law, British mandate law, Jordanian law, Israeli law. The courts have to navigate all of it. A property dispute in the old city can require expertise and Ottoman imperial decrees from the 1800s.
That's not an exaggeration. The Ottoman Land Code of 1858 is still cited in Israeli courts in property cases. A law passed by the Ottoman Empire before the American Civil War is still determining who owns a building in the Muslim quarter.
The man at Rafa retired in 1994. He said he never figured out the cement permit system. He just learned which officials to ask and which to avoid. He said the system wasn't designed to be understood. It was designed to be navigated.
That's the epitaph for the whole region's legal framework.
It connects back to Daniel's question. The reason Jerusalem's status is unique is that Israel tried to make it simple by applying its own law, but the simplicity was illusory. The underlying complexity of land records, personal status, and historical claims didn't disappear. It just got buried under a new layer of law.
The Egyptian administration of Gaza was the opposite. It didn't try to make anything simple. It just kept the existing mess and added military control. The result was a legal system that was transparently temporary and transparently broken.
Both approaches produced the same outcome, a population living under law it didn't choose, with rights that are contingent and revocable in territory whose final status is unresolved. The only difference is the brand of uncertainty.
Daniel's two questions had the same answer, which is that the legal frameworks were always secondary to the political facts on the ground. Egypt didn't annex Gaza because it didn't want to. Israel annexed Jerusalem because it did. The law was just the paperwork.
The paperwork is still not done. The Jerusalem annexation is still not recognized internationally. The Gaza Strip is still not part of any state. The West Bank is still under military occupation. 60 years on, the legal status of all three territories is still contested.
The one thing that's settled is that nothing is settled.
That's probably where we leave it. The Egyptian period in Gaza is a 19-year footnote that shaped everything that came after. And the Jerusalem annexation is a 60-year legal fact that the world has never accepted. Neither was ever going to be resolved by lawyers.
The lawyers just keep the files in order.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing, as always.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want to send us a prompt, email us at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.